From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the UN Secretary-General says he's deeply concerned about the fate of 230 schoolgirls abducted in Nigeria, as calls for domestic and international action against Boko Haram extremists grow louder.
Because the Nigerians had not been up in arms like they are now, it seems that this came to the attention of the international community rather late. In a sense, I would say it's a question of benign neglect.
Also today, London's top cop says so-called police body cameras will boost transparency, and the 94-year-old futurist who says the fight against global warming is a waste of time.
And we've got to really make it clear to those very silly people who think we can save the planet to cease and desist.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Pro-Russian activists in eastern Ukraine say they will not postpone a referendum on independence planned for Sunday. The announcement comes one day after Russian President Vladimir Putin said the vote should be delayed in order to create the conditions necessary to establish a dialogue in Ukraine. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said postponing a referendum in eastern Ukraine would create conditions for dialogue between the authorities in Kyiv and the separatists. "We call on the representatives of southeastern Ukraine, the supporters of the federalization of the country, to postpone the referendum planned for May 11th," he said. Pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine demanded greater autonomy from Kyiv and said they would hold a vote on independence. Putin also said Moscow had withdrawn its troops from the border with Ukraine. Putin's comments came after his meeting with the head of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The security body said it would soon propose a roadmap to defuse a crisis in Ukraine.
South African President Jacob Zuma is celebrating a landslide victory by his ruling African National Congress in the country's general election. With 70% of the votes counted, the ANC enjoyed an unassailable lead, winning more than 62% of the vote. The opposition Democratic Alliance improved on its performance 5 years ago, taking one vote in five. Political analyst Zanusha Naido told South Africa's E! News channel that after the last vote is counted, the hard work will begin for the ANC.
At the end of the day, yes, they won. They got a resounding reaffirmation by the electorate. But at the end of the day, they have to deliver.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with the leader of Syria's main opposition umbrella group Thursday. Ahmed al-Jarba, president of the Syrian Opposition Coalition, is in the U.S. Capitol lobbying for anti-aircraft weapons to bolster the faltering revolt against President Bashar al-Assad. The United Nations Secretary General has said he's deeply concerned about the fate of 230 schoolgirls abducted in Nigeria. Ban Ki-moon and other UN officials are now calling on all parties involved to speed up the safe return of the students. Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
It's the first time Ban Ki-moon has commented officially on the abductions and the girls that have been missing for more than 3 weeks. He says he shares the anguish of the families of the girls and the people of Nigeria at this traumatic time. While the UN is not offering any material support, they are urging those involved to exert any influence they have to bring back the 230 girls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants. Top UN officials have also contacted the Nigerian government, asking it to redouble its efforts to secure the girls' release.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Shares in Barclays rose 8% in London trading after the British bank unveiled plans to cut around 20,000 jobs by the end of 2016. 9,000 of the jobs being cut are based in Britain, with 7,000 alone coming from the bank's troubled investment division. The bank's CEO, Anthony Jenkins, says the job losses will help rebalance the bank.
Regulation now means that a lot of activities just aren't economic anymore. And of course, the economy has affected certain aspects of investment banking. So regrettably, we do need to reduce our investment bank workforce as we focus the business.
A U.S. FBI agent arrested in Pakistan for trying to board a flight with bullets and a knife in his luggage has been released on bail. Joel Cox was arrested on Sunday at the airport in Karachi. From Washington, Kate Fisher reports.
Joel Cox was released to the US consulate after paying bail of 1 million rupees, which is $10,000. He'd been remanded in custody after appearing in court on Tuesday on charges of carrying unauthorized ammunition on a civilian flight. The US says he was on a temporary assignment in Pakistan. His equipment, including his laptop, has been sent to a forensic laboratory for testing. The US State Department says Washington is working closely with Pakistan to resolve Cox's arrest.
And police in London have started experimenting with body-worn cameras in the largest trial of the technology ever undertaken. 500 cameras have been distributed to officers patrolling 10 of London's 32 boroughs. Officers will wear the cameras at shoulder level and will be empowered to switch them on to assist in the collection of evidence. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Secretary General of the United Nations says he's deeply concerned about the abduction of over 200 Nigerian schoolgirls and shares the anguish of the girls' families and the people of Nigeria. Ban Ki-moon's statement comes nearly 4 weeks after the mass kidnapping by extremists in the northeast of the country and as the US dispatches a team of experts to bolster the rescue effort. For some background on Boko Haram and the Islamist group's possible motivation for seizing the teenagers, we hear now from a former US ambassador to Nigeria. Princeton Lyman is now with the US Institute of Peace here in Washington, but from 1986 to 1989 he served as the US ambassador in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. He told Debbie Turner-Bell of Arise News that the United States' effort to assist the Nigerians must now be accepted by the Nigerian government itself.
As this particular set of incidents has raised so much attention and, frankly, embarrassment of the government, that it was impossible for them to say, yes, we do need this help, and for the U.S. to respond the way we are. And this is going to be very important, that the people we send get the cooperation of the security services to be able to help.
And that was exactly my next question, is how effective do you think this help will be?
Well, this is going to be a big test. There are elements I know in the security establishment who want to take a broader and better approach to this problem. The National Security Advisor, Samba Tsuki, put out a very broad-based hearts and minds approach that combined both the military and the intelligence and the outreach. But that's not necessarily the way the government is operating and not necessarily the way the military is operating. So I worry about these divisions, and I think it's going to take very strong leadership from the top and public pressure for them to utilize the kind of assistance that we're prepared to offer.
Let me ask you to shed some light on the area of Nigeria that we're talking about. What is the terrain like? What is this area really like?
This is a part of the Sahel region. It's not desert, but it's quite quasi desert. It's dry. Part of it is forested and scrub bush, which makes it, I think, difficult to find out exactly where people are, even by air, etc. It's not thickly populated. So you have to know where the people are, and there are places for people to hide.
Boko Haram, of course, finally came forward, claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, and then, of course, the supposed leader of Boko Haram then made threats that these girls would be sold in the, quote, open market. What would you surmise the end game for them is with this act?
Well, I think, you raised some very important questions. In the long delay before they took responsibility, I was hoping that this represented some split within them, that there were elements of Boko Haram says, no, this is going much too far. But what's happened is the leader has now stepped forward and not only taken responsibility, but boasted about it, and then they kidnapped further. There is no question that they do use criminal activities to raise money. They rob banks. They kidnap people for ransom. So money could be part of it. But the ideology of this group is to attack the establishment, both the Islamic establishment in Nigeria and the government. So they have attacked mosques and Islamic schools and killed many Muslims, as well as attacking churches. What this suggests, and the terrible attack that took place at this village just the other day, is that in some ways it is getting more vicious and in a bolder, in a terrible way. And if there's any silver lining in this, it may be that if there has been any sympathy toward this group within the Nigerian population, that that should disappear now.
Former ambassador to Nigeria, Princeton Lyman, talking to Debbie Turner-Bell of Arise News. Now, one theory on the sluggish reaction to the incident, both in Nigeria and internationally, is the idea that terrorist violence in African nations is viewed as commonplace, an unavoidable reality of the continent. To explore this attitude, I spoke to Professor of Political Science at UCLA, Edmund Keller.
With Nigeria, because the Nigerians had not been up in arms like they are now, mm-hmm. up until just now, it seems that this came to the attention of the international community rather late. And so, you know, in a sense, I would say it's a question of benign neglect.
Why do you think this abduction has been that catalyst perhaps for change in attitude, both domestically and internationally, towards the campaign of terror conducted for many years now by Boko Haram?
Well, you know, it's only recently that Boko Haram has been linked to, possibly linked to Al-Qaeda. And when you look at the big picture in the in North Africa, in the Sahel area or the Maghreb area, Al-Qaeda has been intensifying its activity, winning more converts, and this is sort of like a creeping cancer, creeping down into sub-Saharan Africa, and Nigeria seems to be the most recent evidence of that.
Former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, Princeton Lyman, just told us that if there's a silver lining to be taken from this situation, it's that sympathy for Boko Haram in Nigeria has been eroded by their actions. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's a big problem. You know, I think that what we have to take note of the fact that the countries surrounding Nigeria, most of which have a large Muslim population, have been reluctant to become involved simply because they don't want to be fighting other Muslims. But at the same time, you know, these kind of atrocities transcend religion. I think that that's the important thing that we need to bear in mind. You know, Boko Haram, right now, its activities go much beyond what might be considered valid religious ideology. It's going to take a coordinated effort on the part of neighbors, as well as those who, up until now, have been reluctant to strike out at Boko Haram, simply because they felt that they were brothers and brothers should not fight brothers.
This is FSN Reports. As a powerful government agency prepares to vote on a proposal to fundamentally change internet access across the US, major tech companies, members of Congress, and some of the agency's own members are protesting. The rule in question would allow web service providers like Verizon and Comcast to create fast lanes for certain websites and content for a fee, leaving those who can't pay in a slow lane. In Washington, our correspondent Alice Olstein reports that a group of activists have set up a protest encampment outside the agency to pressure them to reconsider the impact of the upcoming vote on the media, social movements, and ordinary web users.
Outside the Federal Communications Commission building, tucked away in southwest D.C., a handful of activists held up bright red signs cut to look like flames. They're here to protest a proposed ruling on so-called net neutrality, and they're calling themselves the People's Firewall.
Firewall is an internet term for a way to block a virus, and we see this as a corporate virus that they're trying to inflict on the internet through the FCC.
That's local activist Kevin Zeese. He and about five others will be sleeping in sleeping bags outside the FCC tonight, and they'll soon be joined by others from New York, North Carolina, and Boston ahead of the agency's vote on May 15th to start a rulemaking process on a network neutrality rule. The proposal, drafted by current FCC chair and former cable lobbyist Tom Wheeler, would allow something called paid prioritization. Essentially, companies could pay extra to get their content to users faster. Former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, who served at the agency for 11 years, told FSN that he fears it will lead to an internet that functions more like cable TV, where providers limit their offerings and consumers can't access certain sites if they can't afford them.
It's not just the bills we pay for broadband, but really the heart of our democracy itself. We don't need gatekeepers and big special interest companies who are able to decide what we're going to see and read, or what the news is, or what advocacy groups are going to be carried on the internet and which aren't, but that's the way that this could very well head.
Kopp said he supports those who have called for years for the FCC to reclassify broadband internet as a telecommunications service, which would allow them to regulate it in the public interest and do more to prevent monopolies. Because it's currently classified as an information service, Verizon and other corporations were able to successfully argue in court last year that the government was violating their free speech rights by making them treat all web content equally.
To argue as distributors of broadband that they have free speech rights or rights to block content that wants to go through their distribution system is just silly, and it's just a denigration of the Constitution and the democracy and plain old common sense.
This week, more than 100 major tech companies also came out publicly against the proposal. Amazon, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google, Facebook, and other web giants slammed the drafted rule as a grave threat to the internet and warned it could lead to discrimination against startup businesses. Some current FCC commissioners also spoke out this week, one calling for next week's vote to be delayed for a month to allow for more public input, and another saying she opposes all pay-for-priority arrangements. Chairman Wheeler countered by defending his proposal and assuring his colleagues he would never allow internet providers to deliberately block or slow down access to certain sites. But some lawmakers, including Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal, are skeptical.
There are many different shades of obstructing or blocking content. They can be subtle or overt, and any of them blocks listeners from access to essential content, information, programming that they need and deserve.
Blumenthal was one of several members of Congress to write to the FCC earlier this year, urging them to preserve competition and equal access online. Unless they announce a delay in the coming days, the agency will vote on May 15th. If the rule passes, it will be open for several weeks of public comment before final approval. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, police in London have started deploying body-worn cameras in the largest trial of technology ever undertaken. 500 cameras have been distributed to officers patrolling 10 of London's 32 boroughs. Officers will wear the cameras at shoulder level and will be empowered to switch them on to assist in the collection of evidence. The cameras shoot across a 130-degree angle and can capture around 12 hours of footage that's uploaded to a cloud-based computer server at the end of each officer's shift. The video will be deleted after 1 month unless it's needed as part of an ongoing legal case. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner is Sir Bernard Hogan Howe, and he explained the rules governing the camera's use to Nick Ferrari of Britain's LBC Radio.
We've decided in the end, Nick, that we're just going to switch it on when we're attending incidents, and we're going to trial it in that way and see how that works. We think that strikes the right balance so that it's not too much intrusion, but it does capture all the evidence we need for two reasons. One, for the courts, and two, to hold our officers to account. Most of the time, I know they do a fantastic job, but if that's not the case, then we all should know.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm coming down the high street with a few DVD recorders and some silver candlesticks under my arm. Am I informed that the camera's being switched on, or does your officer just do it anyway?
Well, generally, the idea is that the officer would inform you. So, you know, what normally happens, a member of the public rings in and says they're worried or a crime's been committed. We send by radio one of our officers, and as they arrive there, they can switch the thing on, and their instruction would be, you need to tell the people that you are recording. Now, the victim has got the opportunity to say, I'm sorry, I don't want that to happen. That's entirely up to them. The suspect will not have that option. If something happens in front of the officer, obviously they're going to have to react to that, and I'm sure they'll do their best to first of all switch it on and warn the suspect. But equally, if somebody's running away from you having discarded their candelabra, then I suppose, you know, occasionally it might not happen. I think everyone will accept that. People, they'll just, the officers will have to do their best. But I think 90% of the time, you know, they should be able to make a proper recording. And I don't know if you've seen or heard the video examples we've given. It's a really powerful tool when you go to an event of domestic violence. It doesn't only capture the fact somebody's hurt, it captures the fear in a way that words on a statement never can, or the fact a child's terrified. And that is really powerful evidence that helps to convict people, even when sometimes the complainant isn't prepared to pursue it.
What about data protection aspects here?
We should be fine. I mean, that's one of the things that we need to make sure we get right. So, first of all, we will not keep the material beyond 31 days. So if it's just we capture information that's not relevant to a criminal investigation, then we'll get rid of it. If we capture information that is relevant, then obviously we'll keep it until the court appearance or the appeal is out of the way. So that's the only information we intend to keep.
Metropolitan Commissioner Sir Bernard Hogan-Howe talking to LBC's Nick Ferrari. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, an issue no less enormous than the future of planet Earth. James Lovelock is a British scientist and environmentalist who has devoted his life, nearly 90 years of it, to exploring theories about our planet. He originally proposed the Gaia hypothesis, which argues that Earth regulates its own environment through a biosphere that maintains the health of the planet. Now, at a time of increased concern about global warming, James Lovelock has written a new book, A Rough Ride to the Future. It controversially argues that saving the planet from climate change is beyond our ability. James Lovelock spoke to Ian Sample, science correspondent for Britain's Guardian newspaper, and told him that the welfare of human beings is central to the welfare of the planet.
Without information, you can't get anywhere. I mean, we've got where we are by blind chance. Darwinian natural selection is a chancy process. And it's taken us, goddammit, nearly 3 billion years to get here. That's awful slow. And the Earth doesn't have that much longer left to develop further things.
You talk in the book about how it's crucial for us to survive, almost for other life on Earth to survive as well. And you mentioned that cities might have a role in this. Where do cities come in?
Well, I think in the evolution of the nearest model to us in the animal world, the nearest model is the ants and termites, little insects like that. They learnt very early on that the most efficient way of living is to live in a city, which they call a nest. And you get special cases of it with a termite's nest in Australia and tropical countries, where there can even be great air conditioning towers built up specially for the benefit of the inhabitants of the city. And that's existed for nearly 100 million years, so it must be good.
Where does that play a role for our future then? I mean, we already live in cities, urbanisation is carrying on apace.
Exactly. Well, let's take advantage of it. You see, instead of talking about saving the planet, air conditioning the planet, changing the temperature of the planet, it's bad enough that we're doing it accidentally. To do it deliberately, I think, is absolutely criminal. Don't do that. Do what the termites do. Say, well, that's happening. How do we live without that? And to air condition a city to the temperature you want is quite easy compared with the planet.
Do you think we should give up trying to save the planet then?
Exactly. We should not only we've got to give it up, and we've got to really make it clear to those very silly people who think we can save the planet to cease and desist.
You talk also about in the future of the merging of humans and electronics. Why do you see that happening, and what do you see the consequences of that?
Well, it is happening. I've got a pacemaker in me, and that's a bit of electronic gear that just sits in, operates according to my physiology, and sends signals to my heart to make sure it beats at the right time. for whatever the occasion is. That's only a very primitive start. I can see it won't be long before that thing, which at the moment has a 10-year battery, isn't powered by my bodily system and is much more automatic. And people have already got implants in their brains that will enable them to hear, who are otherwise deaf, implants that will enable them to see a bit when they were blind. Now, it's important to recognize that the brain is so flexible that it can take in digital signals along wires leading to implants like that and translate them into sight or sound, as the case may be. It's much more flexible than we'd ever dreamt. Now, this raises the possibility of all sorts of combinations between electronic life forms, which are very fast, potentially, a million times faster than us, and ourselves. And if that isn't a future, I don't know what is.
But do you think for this to become an issue of evolution, of human evolution, this has to be woven into us so that we would pass on to next generations?
Absolutely. And at this stage of the game, I can't envisage anything of that kind that would breed true. But it's very early days. It's the very first steps. Think how long it took the first living cells to turn into something like us. And you realise we're not talking about a few weeks, even a few thousand years. We're talking about millennia and longer.
You're best known probably for Gaia theory. How's that changed in your mind over the past decades?
Very little. It stayed the same thing that it was when it came into my mind in the Jet Propulsion Laboratories of NASA, only 3 years after NASA had been founded, a long, long time ago.
In the book, you talk about trusting Gaia and you refer to the wisdom of Gaia and making Gaia into some sort of intelligent entity.
Well, don't push me too far and things like that. I'm a romantic. I can't help it. I'm much more of a poet by nature than anything else. And I tend to use words like that because I like using words, just like you do. It's part of your job.
You're here with a collection of your life's work in the Science Museum. What does that mean to you?
Oh, it means an immense amount. You've no idea how much. I came here when I was 6 years old, that's almost 90 years ago, I walked up that road along there with my mother and father. They were going to the Victoria and Albert, and I'm sure it was my father who was wise and who knew that I would be bored to tears with the art exhibition that they wanted to see. Said, look, why don't you go over the road there and see those steam engines they've got there? And of course, people forget all that time ago, steam engines were as exciting to young boys, as airplanes and all sorts of spacecraft and things are today. And so I was only too delighted to enter the Science Museum, which was this wonderful cave of wonders.
The British scientist James Lovelock, whose new book is called A Rough Ride to the Future. An exhibition of his drawings, notebooks and inventions has just opened at the Science Museum in London. And that's where he was interviewed by Ian Sample of The Guardian newspaper for its Science Weekly podcast. You can find it online at theguardian.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Friday, Open Sesame, the Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba that's about to go public. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.